Is the practice of politics providing for the citizen as envisaged in the original Greek meaning, or is it simply a game? And if it is a game, what are the rules? And when playing that game, should we always be aware of our core principles? I am Baroness Saida Varsi. Welcome to my lecture, Personal Principles and the Political Game.
So good evening and welcome to all of you here in the Lady Mitchell Hall and everyone in the Overflow Hall. This is the start of the 31st series of Darwin College lectures. The theme for this 2016 series is games. Of course, we're all familiar with games and we have our own favourites. But as always in these lectures, we're exploring the wider reaches of the theme. And we'll start the series today with the game of politics, that house of cards that fascinates us all. After all, Aristotle did call humans political animals. As a Canadian, I rather like J.K. Galbraith's comment that politics is not the art of the possible. It consists in choosing between the disastrous and the unpalatable. So to give our first lecture tonight, I'm delighted to welcome Saida Varsi, the Right Honourable Baroness Varsi. She will be well known to us all, having been co-chair of the Conservative Party, as well as Senior Minister of State in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and Minister of State for Faith and Communities. In The Magic Mountain, Thomas Mann comments, "What good would politics be if it didn't give everyone the opportunity to make moral compromise?" Wow, is that right? Or was it the altitude of Davos speaking there? Now, Baroness Varsi will speak to us on personal principles and the political game. She's well qualified to address these matters, since she is a member of that rare and honourable team of players who did not make moral compromises. She resigned from the game on a point of principle, when she felt she could not support actions that were not consistent with the rule of law and our long support for international justice. Thus, I look forward to a splendid discussion. Baroness Varsi.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much, Mary, for that very kind introduction. Although I don't know whether, ladies and gentlemen, you noticed the way in which the introduction flowed, but my introduction started immediately after Mary uttered those words, disastrous and unpalatable. So, now, us politicians like doing these talks, if for no other reason, because when we arrive here, people usually list a whole range of anecdotes and various awards and prizes and accolades that have been given to you in the past. That massages our ego, it sets us up for this speech. But somehow, Mary, for me, disastrous and unpalatable did not. But if you will allow me possibly to get me into the right frame of mind, ladies and gentlemen, I will tell you about an accolade that I'm particularly proud of. And that was back in 2008, when I was voted the sexiest member of the House of Lords. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been to the House of Lords. But it is one that sits on my mantelpiece and I remind my husband of regularly. But today, ladies and gentlemen, we both have an impossible task. My job is to stop you from falling asleep over the next 50 minutes. And your job is whether I succeed or fail, you have to pretend that you are still awake at the end. I have been assured that however this talk goes, you will still applaud because the people in Cambridge are polite. but I hope it will be rapturous, and I hope it will be because you have actually heard the talk. In many ways, being here giving the Darwin Lecture is coming of full circle for me, because my political career started with somebody who was a Darwin Fellow, Oliver Letwin. It was Oliver who, when I was being opinionated from the back of the room many years ago at Conservative Party conference, who picked me out and asked whether I should consider standing for Parliament. So in many ways, it was clearly what he learnt here that made him make the mistakes he made in later life. I am sure there are many a colleague who have questioned Oliver's judgment in picking me out and asking me to stand. If I'd been asked some 30 years ago to give a talk on games, I think you would have received a monologue of moves in Monopoly, the language of Ludo, or the detail of drafts. I could have discussed the need to be nimble-footed in netball and hawkish in hockey. But not in my wildest imagination would I have thought that the talk would relate to politics. As the second of five girls born into a traditional Muslim Pakistani immigrant family, games, board games, were the safe space which was classified for us as leisure time. And games in school was the competition space in which I never excelled. Games were what we learnt about in history when we studied the Greeks, where the only areas that my school seemed to cover were the gods and the Olympics. And games in my coming of age year at 21 was that amazing Pakistan versus England World Cricket final, World Cup cricket final, with its nail-biting finish and its heroic-looking players. Now, I was asked, ladies and gentlemen, whether I should like to do a PowerPoint alongside my presentation, and I thought that it would be nice to break up my speech with that, and therefore let me give you the heroic-looking players. We all remember them, and we all fancied them. Fast forward by three decades, and games for me conjures up images of dark corners, dodgy deals, and disingenuous dialogue. So where did it all go wrong? Well, allow me to start with some definitions, some history, and my own journey into politics. Described by Aristotle altruistically as of, for, or about citizens, politics was the science to create well-being for citizens. I thought I needed to replace it with something more intelligent. So, in modern times, the definition of politics has been more broadly cast to include the activities associated with the governance of a country or other area, the debate within political ideologies, or conflict between parties having or hoping to achieve power. But for me, politics represented the journey from activism to application, and from interpreting and applying the law to making the law. I spent my 20s qualifying and practicing as a lawyer. I specialised in criminal defence, mental health tribunal representation, and human rights law. I learnt the art of making a case fit the rules, but with the sense that sometimes the rules themselves could be better. I volunteered with the Racial Equality Council, the Joseph Rowntree Trust, and I campaigned for greater participation of ethnic minorities in public life. I felt able to reconcile my identity as a British Asian with an affection for my Pakistani origins, and that although there were still challenges for ethnic minorities in Britain, we were heading in the right direction. I felt that although there were laws and rules that could be improved, in the most part, living by those laws and rules felt comfortable. And then the rules of the game changed. Now, most of us can recall where we were and what we were doing as the horror of 9/11 unfolded. We can recall the imagery of the Twin Towers falling. But what I also vividly recall is the use of language immediately after by politicians. The infamous and oft-quoted Bush quote, "Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists. And this signalling of the start of the war on terror, of which we continue to feel the aftershocks, clearly said to me that it was now no longer appropriate to be in grey areas, it had to be black and white. It was clear that identity was to be redefined, that there was less scope for nuance, and the defining feature of otherness had somehow moved from race to religion. And having decided that these battles so recently fought seemed too hard and too soon to fight all over again, in 2002, I left Britain. I travelled to the villages where my parents had come from in the early 60s. I spent a year there and, amongst other things, set up a women's empowerment charity. And I would advise those of you who may frequent neoconservative websites, although I do admit to travelling to Abbottabad, I was not being radicalised by Osama bin Laden or indeed spent any time training in the Torabora Mountains. I thought it was important to get that out. But having spent time away, I realised that we all had a responsibility to play a part, however small that responsibility was, but to ensure that the atmosphere of division did not grow. At that time, I felt that running a campaign or practicing the law wasn't where real change was made, and that to make long-term change, one had to be part of where the decisions were made. And I therefore threw my hat in the ring to fight for a seat for Parliament. And so the journey in politics began. That, ladies and gentlemen, was actually where the journey got a little bit better. But it's a great picture because it reminds me of my mother's saying when I started in politics. She wasn't too keen on the idea. And she said to me, it only ever ends badly for politicians. So why would you ever want to enter that profession? But having ignored her at that point and getting involved in politics, I recall that the only person's voice that I could hear on my very first day of cabinet, when I walked up Downing Street and I was asked by the press pack to pose for a photograph outside number 10, as we are asked on cabinet day, when they asked me to take my coat off for a better photograph, I could hear my mother's voice saying, do not put that on the floor. Hence, it's on the railings. But my first election campaign, the 2005 general election campaign, taught me some early and painful lessons about the game of politics. I had understood that the campaign was like sport, a competition, but I also thought, like sport, the competition was played out in accordance with rules. It's not often that politicians open up about how they got it wrong. But being out of the game, ladies and gentlemen, allows me to reflect both on achievements, but also on where things could have been handled differently. In preparation for this lecture, Personal Principles and the Political Game, I've looked back on what I considered to be either my defining personal principles or the moral norms upon which I conducted my professional life and how I implemented or departed from them in my political life. And the 2005 general election campaign provides me with one such case study. This was my first election campaign. I'd never fought a town or a council or a county election before, and yet found myself in a potential winnable seat against an unscrupulous but seasoned opponent in the glare of the media spotlight and during a politically toxic environment. A combination of lack of experience and a lack of faith in my own judgment in a new forum persuaded me to outsource the campaign message, which resulted in campaigning that was ruthlessly political and not particularly principled. As someone who had been hands-on as a lawyer, from the way in which I prepared a defense case to owning and running my own practice, my first mistake was not to own the campaign and not to determine the local message, a departure from the norm, a departure from my core principles, led to a campaign, parts of which I still today continue to regret. My second mistake was to focus on short gains, on personal gains, rather than remain true to the definition of politics of, for, or relating to citizens for the result of citizen well-being. The winning became the focus, and in doing so, I had started to tread the slippery path of the end will justify the means. And having, as a lawyer, been rooted in the principle of unbiased, independent advice, politics required the opposite. The doorstep conversation always presented as answers to voters' concerns, only ever from a right-wing ideological position. So a third departure from the norms or principles I was committed to in my professional life. So ladies and gentlemen, three examples of behavior which very early on I found would have been completely alien in my professional life, but had already started to creep into my political life. Now, I explore these not to make a judgment about these practices per se in politics, but as a very personal example of how the practice of politics lends itself so easily to an alternative way of operating. I didn't win. We did reduce the Labour majority, but probably contributed to the increase of the far right vote because of the relentless focus on immigration, both in the Conservative National Campaign in 2005 and in our local campaign. Dewsbury, the seat that I fought, polled the largest number of British National Party votes anywhere in the country. And looking back from a position of principle, I didn't deserve to win. Neither, for that matter, did my opponent. Maybe that's for discussion over dinner. But after the election, I was asked by Michael Howard to take on a vice chairman's role within the Conservative Party. Now, I think it's right to ask that, having not won an election, why was I offered a job? Why did reward follow when the result was not a win? I'm sure there are a number of ways in which the result could have been interpreted as a success. For example, the reduction in the Labour majority, the effective communication during the campaign, or even access to a more diverse set of voters, voters that the Conservative Party had not had access to in previous campaigns. But having said that, we did not win. The rules of a game, let me take the Olympics, are that reward follows a win. In historical Greece, the Olympiads could be rewarded symbolically by being crowned financially through prize funds and politically by raising the trading and negotiating powers of the communities that they belong to. But it's because they had won. And yet in politics, the rules of the game didn't apply in the same logical format. And it was this anomaly, this illogical application of the rules that I, as most politicians, was both the beneficiary of and the victim of in later years. It was a situation repeated often, both in government and in opposition, where appointments, jobs, or rewards, as I'm calling them, did not necessarily follow success, nor did failure result in consequences. A departure from the world of business where, as my husband regularly repeats to me, politics operates in a world where sales figures and bonus payments are unconnected and no one questions why. What in business would be seen as lunacy is in politics normal, acceptable, and mainly unquestioned. And where this plays out most starkly and publicly is in a cabinet or shadow cabinet reshuffle. The Labour Party's shadow cabinet reshuffle of last week has been an interesting case in point. Now, I don't know if any of you are watching War and Peace, but I think that kind of summed up the Labour cabinet reshuffle. With no logic of why some people were removed and others were not, why some people were rewarded and others were not, why briefs were given to people who were so obviously wrong for that subject matter, much of the political commentary featured phrases like messy, chaos, and shambolic. Now, putting aside the media biases and the political spin, both subjects that I will return to, it was obvious that the normal rules of hiring and firing simply did not apply. What should have been the important and serious moment of setting out the team, that as the official opposition would hold the government to account to ensure that the government fulfilled its responsibilities and duty to its citizens, instead, both from within the Labour Party and outside, presented as a game, an activity engaged in for amusement. Now, my own experience of a cabinet reshuffle was similarly chaotic. After the 2010 general election, I was appointed Conservative Party chairman and cabinet minister as a minister without portfolio. The first major reshuffle took place in September of 2012. And the night before the formal reshuffle began, I was invited for a chat with the Prime Minister. I was offered an alternative role, and that role neither excited me nor I felt was one that played to my strengths. And I refused the role and indicated that I was happy to step down from cabinet. The rest of the story, ladies and gentlemen, I will leave for another place and time. But what was interesting was that the number of rules that were broken during that reshuffle that would in any non-political environment be considered basic requirements. From the disconnect between success and reward, to the lack of reasoning for a change, to the inappropriateness and informality of the negotiations, to the ultimate appointment of a successor who had been the topic of many a discussion over the preceding years about his alleged undermining of the very office that he now took over. Not only had the rules not been applied, the book had been well and truly shredded. And the reverse application of this no rules approach in the workplace is the job for life scenario for MPs in safe seats, and the worst manifestation is the appointments in the House of Lords. And I say that as somebody who is a member of that House. It is quite literally a job for life. Now, there are some behaviours we all instinctively know are wrong, even when we are doing them. Whether it's centuries of religious teaching, whether it's rooted in philosophical thinking, or whether it's the memory of a clip round the back of the ear when you were young, you know that certain things are wrong. Telling a lie, not telling the truth, or maybe not even telling the whole story, knowing the consequences of misinterpretation. In political circles, this has become an art form. In the UK, the cult of the special advisor, the SPAD or the spin doctor, is one which was brought right into our living rooms in the middle, in the form of Malcolm Tucker in the BBC drama The Thick of It. He was painted as a dysfunctional individual whose job was to ensure that the minister's office was functional. And I want to talk a little bit about the rise of the SPAD. There is an official title for them. I don't know if you can read that. They are non-official extra civil servants public appointees seconded to the minister in an advisory role. And as he said there, you know, call a SPAD. Now that is fiction, but at the last general election, the three people who were potentially vying to run this country were all SPADs. So going back to SPADs, spin has across the world become a standard feature in political environment. The public seem to accept it, huge careers have been built on it, and yet when we unpick the values or principles that both underpin spin and are displayed in the practice of spin, we would instinctively know that if we'd done it as a child, our mum would have given us a clip round the back of the ear. Edward Bernays, the father of the modern spin doctor, was the son of Austrian immigrants who migrated to the US. His use of what was widely identified as propaganda, but what he referred to as public relations due to the negative connotations associated with the term propaganda, are as familiar today as they were a century ago. Let me explore briefly a few of them. The selective presentation of facts. I think we're all aware when that is done, and mostly we see it around the time of the budget. One of the reasons why the Conservative Party, as part of the coalition government, brought in the Office for Budget Responsibility was to try and bring some credibility to the figures that are brought forward. The evasive denial. We all recall the famous 1997 speech in which Tony Blair said, "We do not have plans to bring in tuition fees." Not having plans was not the same as possibly considering them and bringing them in when we got in. The disingenuous apology. Sorry not for the act, but for the offence. An apology without an acknowledgement of wrongdoing, used to usually lance the boil, get the press off your back. And sometimes this is done by framing the apology as an abstract, such as mistakes were made, rather than saying, I made a mistake. It allows us an opportunity to draw a line under the matter without taking any form of personal responsibility. And of course, burying bad news. Announcing unpopular things at a time when it's believed that the focus of the media or indeed citizens will be on other things. And successive governments have been famous for doing this just before the summer recess or just before the Christmas break. Much of this conduct is used extensively at election time as political parties lay out their manifestos, the terms of their contract with the voter. And yet, what should be a time when the role of political parties is to engage in a way in both conduct and information that allows the public to make an informed choice. Once again, we see techniques being used which misinform the public. And if these techniques were used, say, in a commercial setting at the time of a contractual negotiation in the commercial world, we can envisage that litigation would follow, what effectively would be breaches of civil law and may, in some cases, stem into criminal law. So once again, the game of politics is played by rules that in professional and indeed in personal conduct would be deemed either against the law, but certainly morally wrong, and contrary to what most people would cite as their personal principles. Now, I agreed to give this lecture many, many, many months ago, and a lot of things have changed since then. And like a lot of things that I agree to do, I come back to them a few weeks before I'm due to do them. And the conversation usually goes something like this. Who agreed to this event? It usually ends with a long conversation by saying, you did. At which point, I looked at the brief again, and I couldn't imagine why, in the middle of a Christmas break, I had agreed to a lecture for 50 minutes in Cambridge that I would have to prepare over the Christmas break, with an audience full of very clever people, amongst a lineup of decorated academics who were going to tackle the subject after me and clearly much better. And therefore, I decided that I needed to have in my lecture a clever bit. So bear with me. This may be the bit when you fall asleep. Games theory, the science of logical decision-making in rational beings and its application to politics. Researchers, pollsters, strategists have developed a whole series of games theories and models which use different players to predict what would be voting behavior and political outcomes, diplomacy outcomes in politics. An early application of this was an economic theory of democracy, which is as relevant today, half a century on, which understood political ideologies, two-party democracies and coalitions, convergence on the center ground as the basis to win elections, something Tony Blair almost perfected, and the emergence and growth of new political parties, which we've seen in recent years, like UKIP and the SNP. It also provides interesting theory of how a misinformed electorate can provide fertile ground for more entrenched and pointed political ideological positions. I want to expand a little on a game theory that, as well as its relevance in politics, was a familiar scenario for me in my previous life as a criminal defense lawyer. And is an interesting prism within which to explain an aspect of government policy which takes me right back to my early days in politics, but I also believe explains the potential long-term damaging effects of getting that policy wrong, counterterrorism. And the games theory that I want to refer to, ladies and gentlemen, is the prisoner's dilemma. It shows why two completely rational individuals might not cooperate, even if it appears that it's in their best interest to do so. Now, if you look at this particular diagram, it explains how this dilemma operates. Here, regardless of what the other person in this scenario decides, each prisoner gets a higher reward by betraying the other. This was something that I came across during multi-handed criminal investigations, usually involving drugs or conspiracy to commit robberies, where a series of defendants would be arrested at the same time, represented by different solicitors, each being given their own advice and each not knowing the detail of the interview that was happening with their co-defendants. And the reasoning that's involved, an argument in this dilemma, is that either B or A will cooperate or defect. If B cooperates, A should defect because going free is better than serving a year, as it's detailed there. If B defects, A should also defect because serving 2 years is better than serving three. So either way, A should defect. Parallel reasoning will show that B should too defect. In traditional games theory, some very restrictive assumptions on prisoner behavior are made. It is assumed that both understand the nature of the game and that despite being members of the same gang or the same crime, they have no loyalty to each other and will have no opportunity for retribution or for reward after. Most importantly, a very narrow interpretation of rationality is applied in defining the decision-making strategies of the prisoners. And given these conditions and the payoffs above, prisoner A will betray prisoner B. The game is symmetric, so prisoner B should act in the same way. Since both rationally decide to defect, each receives a lower reward than if both were to stay quiet. Traditional games theory results in both players being worse off than if each chose to lessen the sentence of his accomplice at the cost of spending more time in jail himself. So what all of that boils down to, ladies and gentlemen, is that a more altruistic approach would have led to a better outcome for both. And as I've said, this is something that I came across regularly in my professional life. It has also been proposed that this games theory can explain stability in different forms of government. And this theory was applied repeatedly to determine what kind of underlying behaviours and underlying principles led to the best outcomes. And what the analysis showed, and there were various conditions that needed to be met to determine it, was that the more altruistic an approach that was adopted by both parties, the better the outcome for both parties. And the kind of behaviours they looked around were strategies that were nice, strategies that did not always retaliate, but sometimes did, strategies that were forgiving, and strategies that were non-envious. And I tried to pick out all of these particular approaches in relation to a modern policy area, which is almost in the news on a daily basis. It's something that I've spoken about in the past, and that is this. Successive governments have had a challenge about how and how far they engage with British Muslim communities, some of which whose ideas and opinions they do not agree with. Unfortunately, over the last 6 or 7 years, starting with the last Labour government, which continued through the coalition years and continues to be the policy now, there has been a rising policy which I define as the non-engagement of British Muslim communities. The thinking behind it is that if more and more individuals and groups whose views we do not like are effectively disengaged with, then over a period of time, more and more people will move to a position which effectively means they will be in the space where we want them to be. However, the reasoning behind this policy and some of the evidence which is used as the basis of assessing who is and who isn't beyond the pale is questioned. And what it has led to 6 years on is a general alienation amongst large sections of the British Muslim community who feel that government is not interested. So the CT dilemma I have drawn up in two ways, the balance, of course, between security and liberty, but the breadth and depth of Muslim engagement and how parties do that. And I've put it through the prism of the prisoner's dilemma. The reason I raise this, ladies and gentlemen, is because ultimately what we see is that the behavior that is being displayed by both sides of the political divide, left and right, is not an altruistic approach to be able to come up with the right policy outcome, but an approach which leads to the right electoral outcome. And on the Muslim engagement policy choices, it boils down to this. Different approaches to minority rights in terms of left-wing and right-wing parties. Left-wingers, generally consistent with the leftist political thinking, at ease with diversity, more likely to adopt a multicultural approach resting on recognising difference. Right-wing, consistent with centre-right political theory, more likely to adopt an assimilationist political idea, prioritising majority values and insisting minorities assimilate, much like the Prime Minister's muscular liberalism that he's talked about. The policy choices for the left wing then is between staying the course and engaging with a wide range of Muslim organisations, even those with whom they may be culturally and politically in disagreement with, or adopting a more Tory-esque approach to generate political electoral advantage. The example would be Tony Blair's speech in 2006, where he talked about a duty to integrate and the politics of the decent left. I think it was broadly known as Blue Labour. The policy choices for right-wing is between continuing with an assimilationist discourse, the muscular liberalism, or adopting a wider, deeper engagement with British Muslim communities, an integrationist approach, which recognises that integration is a two-way street and that the majority and minority are both transformed by the process of integration. Now, the dilemma for Labour is this. Choosing between wider Muslim engagement consistent with principles on the left, very much the view of John Denham, and a narrower approach adopting the discourse of the right, which was probably where Hazel Blears was. The dilemma for Conservatives is choosing between the prejudices of some of the neoconservative elements and the Daily Mail fantasists, and an open dialogue with a wider set of Muslim organisations privileging the rule of law and British values as a basis of integration. The cost of poor choices by Labour or Conservative is alienation and an environment much more fertile for alienation and radicalisation. The cost of the right choice by a respective political party is political disadvantage. So in their respective constituencies, right or left, Labour criticised for allowing minorities to engage in identity politics, Conservatives criticise for undermining British values and culture and letting minorities do what they want. But a sound policy outcome. If both made the right policy choices, i.e. a deeper dialogue with Muslim communities, that is good for Muslims and society at large. A focus on the altruistic characteristics that I have referred to previously, combined with the principled position of acting for the citizen or for the state, as opposed to personal political gain, could overcome and provide a safer state and a decrease of the toxic environment in which radicalization can breed. As I have said over and over again, the role in CT for us should be to ensure that more and more people are inside the tent and fewer people are put outside the tent. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to move to my two final areas, the players in the game and my dilemma. So first, the players. Who are they and what does the nature of the game determine? What does the nature of the game determine as to who can and who cannot play? Let me go back to Aristotle's citizens. Although even what at first blush feels like a very principled definition that is altruistic and it is of and for the citizens, this is somewhat clouded when we realise that the definition of citizen doesn't include the poor, the slave, the old, women, or children, and not even able-bodied men who did not have the fortune of being born in Greece. In relation to ancient Greek games participants, only free men who spoke Greek were allowed to participate in the ancient games of classical times. Only young people who could prove that they had been in training for at least the last 10 months. Participants were limited mainly to male athletes, and in later times, men competed in the nude, and married women were forbidden from observing them. And if they did, they were given the death penalty. Now, although universal suffrage has in the UK meant we no longer fall short in the way that Aristotle's definition did, it's still important to remember that we did so until some 88 years ago. That was more than 2,300 years after Aristotle's writings. However, the modern game of politics still finds its players are mainly male, and although, like the Greeks, they don't compete in the nude most of the time, certainly there are aspects of political life that still are charged in a way which can be unwelcoming for women. And if I may quote from an article from about a year ago, which I thought it summed up really fascinatingly the environment. It's hard to credit in 2014, but it's true. There's still a major British workplace, one of the country's best-known brands, where women have no right to take maternity leave. If they do have children, they tend to find that their shift patterns are deeply inflexible, making it all but impossible to maintain a normal family life at the same time as doing the job properly. A difficult thing when there's still a prevailing assumption in their workplace that they and not their husbands should be the ones to shoulder the greater part of the burden at home. Considering all of that, it's perhaps not surprising that there are still some men who work there who think they can get away with deeply creepy behaviour. Behaviour that almost anywhere else would get them sacked. In this workplace, it's not even clear who you would report it to. You may ask, if those women are getting such a crappy deal and if nothing much is changing, can't anyone else do anything about it? Why can't Parliament act, for instance? And it's a good question, albeit one with a slightly confounding answer. The reason Parliament can't act is both simple and complicated. Parliament can't act because it's the very place with the problem. That I thought summed it up very neatly. Now, turning, ladies and gentlemen, to my dilemma, the last part of my talk, the one that I faced in the summer of 2014. If I can start with a quote from Martin Luther King, there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular, but he must take it because conscience tells him it is right. This was the night before the resignation. The commemoration services for the First World War were still ongoing, and I was quite poignantly asked as a minister to put out one of the candles at Westminster Abbey. It was a decision in the middle of the Gaza conflict which I had thought about long and hard. The war had been going on for a number of weeks, and I at the time was minister for communities and faith, but also the senior foreign office minister with responsibility for human rights, for international justice, for the ICC, and I was the minister for the United Nations. And at that moment in time, I felt that all the things that I had for the last 2 years as a foreign office minister, had the privilege of traveling the world and speaking to foreign ministers across the world about British values, about our commitment to human rights, our belief in accountability, about our campaign against impunity for war crimes, about the international community acting collectively, the support for international forums like the United Nations and the Human Rights Council, suddenly found that every aspect of what I had believed in, we somehow didn't seem to want to follow. It may well be that I go into a little more detail, but I felt, ladies and gentlemen, that by now you've probably had enough of listening to me standing here, so you may want to listen to me on the screen instead. I hope, ladies and gentlemen, you're still with me and you're still awake. But I think that really sums it up for me. Say what you believe and do what you say. They seem to be really simple statements, but a fantastic prism through which you can judge whether or not the policy that you're applying is fundamentally in line with what we believe as a nation and whether we apply it consistently. The examples that I've cited today, I hope, explain mainly through a practitioner's lens how the world of politics operates, and hopefully allows us to consider, firstly, whether politics is a game. Secondly, if so, is it played by a set of rules which we would recognise in similar scenarios outside the world of politics? Thirdly, is it simply about winning, but about winning to achieve an altruistic end? And fourthly, if it is altruism for the greater good, for and about the citizen and well-being of those for whom politicians govern, then should the rules that govern politics be both clearer and even of higher order than those that we apply in other settings, i.e. not just about the law, but also about principles? And my personal conclusions are these: that politics, which gives the opportunity for the few to govern the many, needs to both follow the laws we take for granted in our personal and professional lives, consistently be mindful of rules outside the law but accepted norms, such as the rules of natural justice, be aware at all times of principles, and only then will we have fairer, greater, and better representation in politics, the players, frank and honest discussion about the issues, the policy, outcomes that stand the test of time for the people, and true glory for those who engage in the game of politics, genuine leadership. And to that end, I want to share two final short thoughts. A quote from Frederick Donaldson, a Christian socialist and a clergyman, from a sermon that he gave in Westminster Abbey in 1925, when he spoke of the seven social sins: wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, commerce without morality, science without humanity, worship without sacrifice, and politics without principles. Beautifully said in 1925, but there was a more modern depiction of politics and taking a principled stance in my very last slide, which was one artist's impression of what he saw a principled position look like. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. You've given us a great deal to consider. We've heard an honest and insightful analysis, a position of principle. It's been very good to hear that phrase. Here in academia, as in business or sport or day-to-day life, we do expect that there are rules and that reward should follow success. So no wonder, perhaps, that people can find it hard to follow political manoeuvring. We don't understand the rules. They're not our everyday rules. Now, next week, the 2016 Darwin College lectures continue, and we may perhaps hear more about the prisoner's dilemma, as Mrs. Nikki Padfield, who's with us here tonight, the master of Fitzwilliam College, is going to be speaking on the game of crime and punishment. But finally, I need to thank again Baroness Worsley for such a really thoughtful analysis. It's very good to hear politics and the holding of personal principles expressed in such clear and open terms. Principles are matters for us all, whether individuals or nations. Thank you very much indeed.